From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 28th day of July 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services. He's in Oakland, Illinois. And later in the half hour, we'll discuss the cash grain market with Matt Blaisdell of the Anderson's Climbers facility in Delphi, Indiana. Along the way, we'll check in on the agricultural weather forecast. Drew Lerner will be here, and I'll bring you up to speed on all the agricultural news for the afternoon. In the second half hour of our program, we call that The Farming World, and it's available on many of these radio stations and, of course, always online at willag.org. We'll dip into the archives one more time. Please stay with us for The Farming World, if you can, right here on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report. It is a production of the University of Illinois.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
In Chicago on this Wednesday afternoon, futures finished like this. The nearby September wheat at 6.15 and a half, 20 and a half cents higher. December at 6.47 for the soft red, up 20 cents. Kansas City hard red September at 6.30 and three quarters, up 15 and three quarters. September corn futures $3.76 and one quarter, up 13 and a half cents. December at 3.90 and three quarters, up 13 and three quarters. In the March, 4.03 and a half, up 13 cents for the day. May corn futures $4.11 and a half, up 12 and three quarters. July at 4.18 and a half, up 12 and one quarter. August soybeans $10.10 and a half, 12 and a half higher. September at $9.85 a bushel, up 12 cents. And November soybeans for the new crop harvest, 9.78, up 12 and a half cents. January 9.86 and three quarters, up 12 and a quarter. March contract $9.90 and three quarters, up 11 and a quarter. August bean meal at $301.70, $7.20 higher. August soybean oil $38.84, up 28 cents. August live cattle futures $92.77 and a half cents, 12 and a half higher. October at $94.20, up 27 and a half. August feeders at $114.52 and a half, down 37 and a half cents. The September at $114.85, down 25 cents for the day. August lean hog futures at $83.37 and a half, up $1.15. In the October there at $76.95, up 72 and a half cents. You are listening to the Closing Market Report from the University of Illinois. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. September crude oil futures, $76.99 a barrel, down 51 cents on the afternoon. The ethanol at $1.64 and a tenth, 3 2/10 higher. Natural gas at $4.77 and 4 tenths, up 9 9/10. And the RBOB gasoline at $2.06, down 0.3 of a cent. Heating oil or diesel fuel for the afternoon at $1.99 and a half, down 0.3 of a cent. Gold futures at $1,160.40, a settlement price up $2.40. The Dow at 10,492, just about 45 points lower on the afternoon. And the Goldman Sachs now at 509.02, and that is up 0.24 for the day. Here's what the weather forecast looks like from Drew Lerner. He said scattered showers should return to the forecast. That'll happen this afternoon and right on through Thursday. But much of that rainfall should be light, says Mr. Lerner, about a half an inch or so. Friday will be drier again, although a few stray showers are anticipated. Saturday and early Sunday morning will bring another wimpy round of precip into a portion of the region, but amounts will be erratic, and they'll be light for the afternoon. Restricted rainfall will occur early next week, and next better chance of rain will occur later in the week. Pockets of firming topsoil, says Mr. Lerner, anticipated over the next 2 weeks. Subsoil moisture should remain fine. That'll support normal crop development. Temperatures will be seasonably warm, mostly in the highs of the 80s and the 90s. Some cooler air should sneak into the Great Lakes, the upper regions. Highs there in the 70s and the 80s. Some deeper cooling may occur late next week, but World Weather Incorporated has its doubts about that verifying. We'll have more details when we get to the bottom of this hour. You are listening to Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and Moline. More information is available from Tim Wells in Moline at 309-797-7369. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
This is the closing market report on a Wednesday afternoon. Time to check in on the agricultural futures markets. Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois, is with us. Good afternoon, Paul.
Good afternoon, Todd.
I've been out of the market for, well, nearly 2 weeks now, and frankly, Paul, I decided not to pay attention. Can you catch me up?
Well, let's go to overnight. And some private weather people had been predicting a lot of rainfall for the Delta. The one I have a lot of confidence in says, hey, it was only about 20% of a half inch or more of beneficial rain from Louisiana to Memphis, and we're going to see very warm to 90 to 100 degree temperatures from now through next Wednesday. That is going to take a toll on that crop. Also, the major crop in the Soviet Union, the Ukraine in the former Soviet Union, you know, 1/6 of the world production of wheat's there, 25% of the world corn production, over half of the world sunflower production there, big barley. It's a growing economy. Back in the old communist days, whenever they had a drought like this, they'd sell off a lot of livestock. Chances are that won't happen. But it's based on tremendous changes in the coarse grain carryover. Possibly a week from now, Monday, we'll probably see crop ratings drop here in the U.S., both on corn and soybeans. And as a result of this, my opinion, and these are my opinions and not necessarily ADM or ADM Investor Services, but I think the world is short-bought. They are used to buying a lot of corn and soybeans, sunflower, vegetable oils, extremely cheap. And one of the big sellers, of course, is the Soviet Union.
All right. So if we set that up, then are you feeling better about this marketplace as we head into this? Is an unusual event. We have a large crop and for corn, that is. We have what looks to be like a large crop there and a rally in the marketplace.
Informa basically said in their morning comments that they feel the season's lows are already in corn, and I probably agree with that. I think the big factor here, Todd, is, of course, the technical trends are higher in corn, soybeans, and wheat. The marketplace is looking at these way above normal temperatures over there, you know, 8 to 14 degree above normal temperatures. Some of the people are examining the corn crop here in the Midwest and saying, you know, it has some shorter kernels than normal. We do think the plant populations are extremely high. So we do have to wait and see what August rainfalls and things like that. But from a farmer and from a commodity trader point of view, these hot temperatures do scare me, and I think that a person that is short has to be a little bit concerned with today's close.
Yeah, can we talk about how that scares you in two ways, old crop and new crop separately? Old crop, we have a lot of corn. I've heard complaints, I suppose. I haven't been completely out of the market over the last couple of weeks, that what's coming in is very out of condition. What's probably left is really out of condition. What does that tell you about the old crop corn supply and the basis for the marketplace? What kind of docks are we dealing with and what the market might do with it?
Okay, number one is that I think a conservative guess is 25%+ of old crop corn carryovers got damage in it. If you need number two corn or better, you're going to have to pay up for that kind of quality. An end user that's short bought probably needs to be concerned. Usually damaged corn has to be isolated. You're going to have lower test weights, lower weight values, and that means less carryover at the end of the year. I think the factor about you know, how high can corn go? Well, you know, I'd probably be a seller of $4 a bushel corn out of the field or at some point in time next year. You know, I was aggressive early of soybeans. I think the old crop carryover is going to be dropped, cut, and it wouldn't be surprised if the carryover next year is going to be cut as well. The other factor here is that, you know, better demand with wheat prices the way they are, we'll probably take 1 to 2 million acres, maybe 3 million acres of more wheat planted. That means new crop corn and soybean prices will probably be better because of that. You know, the arithmetic is for a little kinder, gentler price level for the farmer. We still need help from the government on higher ethanol blends, and we need to hold the EPA and Congress feet to the fire on that issue.
Just for clarification's sake, $4 corn basis December?
I think new crop out of the, I mean, corn out of the field, I think next year at $4.
Cash?
I think it's going to take after the first year before we will see it. But, you know, August is a strange month,
right,
and there's a lot of twists and turns in it. But I do think that we will see some better corn prices after the first of the year.
How about on the beans in November?
Well, we've already sold our $10 new crop beans, you know, out of the field. I think that for those that are still going to have to play catch-up, I think that's a logical area to sell some more beans. Two things. There's going to be some quick shipment premiums, both on old corn and new crop beans out of from the combine. The Chinese are going to take over 1 million tons of beans a week. And, of course, the South American farmer is a very stubborn seller of soybeans. And with the sunflower crop the way it is, you know, better prices could occur.
How soon will harvest in the United States start in earnest? How much
when the farmers,
think?
We're starting to see the annual corn crib of new crop corn ears come to the marketplace. You know, we're starting to see dented corn. I'm going to say conservatively 10 days to 2 weeks earlier than normal around here.
And soybeans are on time?
I think so.
No, they have to be, in part because they're light sensitive, I suppose, but they look like they're on time, right?
Well, and to some extent, the beans are looking great. There are some concerns about Little Egypt, about dry weather. Ashcom, Illinois, you understand there's some dry weather. So, you know, there's some spots of dry weather, but you know, one of the other factors that I still point to is the Delta's 25% of the corn bean crop. Hey, that's where 90 and 100-degree temperatures, and the weatherman says no hurricane for the next 2 weeks. So we have to kind of take them for their word for it. And, of course, the weatherman also says 2 more weeks of hot troubles in the Soviet Union. And a lot of times the same weather people that I'm using, I used in 1972, and they said there's a lot of similarity to major problems in Europe.
All right. Thanks so much.
Have a good day.
You too. Paul Cooley is with ADM Investor Services. He's in Oakland, Illinois. Joins us here on the Closing Market Report. Happens on a Wednesday afternoon. If you'd like to hear Paul again, you can always do that on our website. The address is willag.org. That's willag.org. Or you can dial this phone number. It's 217-333-3434. We call that our mobile analyst portal. We update it with either the opening numbers or the closing numbers and a bit of analysis at about 10:15 and 3:15 daily, 217-333-3434, or visit us online and sign up for our podcast at willag.org.
Support comes from Stewart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stewart-peterson.com.
In today's agricultural news, there's some problems with the NCBA audit. A routine compliance review of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association has revealed some weaknesses in the way the NCBA expenses are charged as beef checkoff activities. The audit covers January 08 through February of 2010 and indicates a pattern of insufficient documentation and noncompliance. Late Tuesday afternoon, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association issued its response to the problems found with the audit. Steve Fogelsong, NCBA president and a producer from Illinois, pledged where mistakes were made that he'll correct them. Fogelsong says NCBA understands the importance of compliance with the financial firewall and accepts this responsibility without question. Let's stay with audits because the USDA's Office of Inspector General has found insufficient evidence to support allegations brought by the American Soybean Association against the United Soybean Board, the U.S. Soybean Export Council, and the law firm of McLeod, Watkins, and Miller. The American Soybean Association says it is pleased that they can put that issue behind its industry. During the review, substantial management and board changes were made at the U.S. Soybean Export Council. The former USEC CEO was placed on administrative leave, and the board of directors has been restructured. As a result of those changes, the checkoff board now believes soybean farmers' interests are being better served. ASA believes soybean farmers benefit from a strong policy organization and its state affiliates, working for them on legislative and regulatory issues, as well as from a soybean checkoff working at the national and state levels. ASA believes it can create the best possible present and future for U.S. soybean farmers and the U.S. soybean industry. We'll have a response from the United Soybean Board a bit later in this program. Let's move now to biofuels, where Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has introduced a limited energy bill that does not include supports for renewable fuels. In a statement, Growth Energy CEO Tom Bias says it's disappointing that the leader did not take the opportunity to include measures that would support the most viable alternatives to imported oil. That's ethanol, according to Bias. Bias took the opportunity, of course, to promote Growth Energy's Fueling Freedom Plan, which establishes a path toward building out the infrastructure necessary to make significant reductions in the nation's use of foreign oil by mandating the production of flex fuel vehicles and the installation of blender pumps. Speaking to Tom Bias and Growth Energy, it's at odds with a research paper released by Iowa State University's Bruce Babcock. The paper suggests that allowing the ethanol tax credit and tariff to lapse would not have much of an impact on the U.S. ethanol industry. According to Growth Energy, Babcock's paper assumes the Environmental Protection Agency approves E15, and it results in the use of a lot more ethanol, as much as 15 billion gallons. Growth Energy has repeatedly pointed out that these government supports are important because ethanol only has access to a small portion of the transportation fuel market. More from the biofuels front, this time some good news. The St. Louis International Airport is one of several around the country that uses soy biodiesel in its airport fleet. Mike Burnich is the fleet manager there. He says they've been using a B20 blend since 1987, and they like it because it has less noxious odors and for all those added environmental benefits.
There's a major reduction in a lot of the emissions over straight diesel just by going to as low a rate as B20 in biodiesel. Biodiesel, as everyone should be well aware of, is a superior lubricity product. We have longer injector life. We have longer engine life on our units that are running B20 now. I haven't had an engine failure, knock on wood, in quite a few years out here.
Burnich says every diesel engine in his fleet is currently running on the B20 blend, including all the fire and rescue equipment. He says, being in an agricultural area, St. Louis, that he's proud to use a product grown and manufactured locally. And that's a look at today's agricultural news. You're listening to the Closing Market Report on a Wednesday afternoon. Please do visit our website. The address is willag.org. That's willag.org. Well, earlier in the program, we referred to the audit of the American Soybean Association of the USB, that's the United Soybean Board, an 18-month review of the soybean checkoff program by USDA's Office of Inspector General found insufficient evidence to support any of the ASA or American Soybean Association's allegations against the USB, the United Soybean Board. Chairman of the board, Phil Bradshaw, says the 68-member USB is encouraged by the IG's findings and looks now forward to giving its undivided attention to building demand for U.S. soybeans and soy products.
I think it just reinforces what we've known all the way along, that we were doing a good program. Everything showed that, you know, we monitor this very closely. And I think it just reassures us, like any other review, any other audit does, that makes you feel comfortable with where we are, and I kind of makes you excited about moving forward.
The Inspector General did recommend closer oversight by USB of the U.S. Soybean Export Council. That's the primary checkoff contractor for international marketing. And Bradshaw says that's already happening.
It is standard practice for the farmer leaders of our board to continually evaluate the effectiveness value, and efficiencies of our contractors. With a detailed review of the USDA report, we will consider additional opportunities where oversight may be necessary.
The investigation started when ASA leaders submitted a petition to former USDA Secretary Ed Schaefer in December of 2008, alleging, among other things, misuse of funds on feeding trials in Europe and what ASA described as potential evasion of salary and administrative caps, along with excessive spending.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Wednesday afternoon. Scott Anderson of the Andersons in Delphi, Indiana, is on the phone line with us today to take a look at the agricultural cash grain markets. Good afternoon to you, Scott. How's the weather there this afternoon, and what is it that you think farmers are mostly thinking about?
The weather right now is, it looks a little overcast to the west of us, so I don't know if we're got some rain headed our way or what, but it is hot and humid right now. Farmers in our area are pretty well getting to the point where they're starting to get cleaned up on corn, or at least working that way anyway.
And they got cleaned up on corn. They're getting pretty close. Are they now satisfied that they want to wait it out for a higher price on new crop sales?
Yeah, I think everybody is maybe held off. It seems like in the last week or two, everybody's kind of held off a little bit on new crop sales just to see what the market is actually going to do here.
And what are your thoughts about where the market's headed?
Well, it feels like things are bullish here for the near term. I think that, you know, both 11 crop and, you know, on out, you know, I'm sorry, 10 and 11 definitely are headed the right direction for the farmer. I mean, it seems like, you know, there's going to be a lot of demand for corn in the future, and that is not going to change anytime soon.
What's underlying that demand? Where do you see it?
There's a lot going on right now with the wheat market, not necessarily in the United States, but in Europe and Russia. There's a lot of talk about, you know, weather in those parts of the world and, you know, a drought. And that looks like it's really put a hurt on those crops as far as basically wheat. And it looks like for the near future anyway, that's going to cause maybe a few more wheat acres planted in the United States even.
And you think crop will be out early enough to make that happen this year finally?
Yeah, it does seem like it. You know, as long as the weather continues kind of similar to what it has been here lately, I would think that we're looking at a, you know, relatively painless, harmless fall this year.
If you're a producer who's thinking about wheat for next year, do you think they should price it out in that case?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think it's definitely something that you want to keep an eye on. But the wheat-corn relationship is the main thing to keep an eye on right now.
How's the uptick in the corn market impacting your ethanol plant?
Right now, we're in fairly decent shape. We are we're actually maybe not as aggressive in this area as what some other ethanol plants are right now. We seem to be seeing corn coming at us at a fairly decent pace, and you know, really that has not that has continued for the last couple of months, and looks like it'll continue through harvest.
Quickly, your corn bid only, please.
Right now, we are 366.
Thanks much, Scott.
Thank you.
Scott Anderson with the Andersons in Delphi, Indiana. Back in 2 minutes.
It's National Milk Chocolate Day, as well as National Cheesecake Day and National Drive-Thru Day. By the way, drive-thru service initially became popular in the restaurant industry in the late 1940s. In-N-Out Burger claims to have built the first drive-thru restaurant in 1948. On this day in agricultural history in 1586, it's claimed that the potato was introduced to England by Sir Thomas Harriot. In 1852, Andrew Jackson Downing died, an American horticulturalist. He was author of The Fruits and Fruit Trees of America. In 1866, the metric system was authorized to standardize weights and measures in the U.S. In 1900, one of the many claims to the origin of the hamburger is that Louis Lansing first served hamburgers on a bun in his diner in New Haven, Connecticut. And in 1907, Earl S. Tupper was born. In the 1930s, Tupper invented a flexible, lightweight material that was used to make plastic gas masks during World War II. After the war, he turned his attention to consumer products, and Tupperware was born. At first, the food storage containers were a flop, but sales ignited with the introduction of the Tupperware party. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Listening to the Closing Market Report on a Wednesday afternoon, I'm Todd Gleason. Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City joins us now to take a look at the agricultural weather forecast. Good afternoon to you, Drew.
Good afternoon.
Tell me about the weather for the next few days, please.
Well, it looks like we will see a favorable environment for our crops out there. You know, all the excess moisture that we've been seeing in the last couple of weeks has really piled up in quite a few areas. So we're going to see a little less frequent, a little less significant rainfall across the region as we go forward through the next next 10 days or so. It's not going to be just absolutely dry. I don't want to kind of suggest that, but I do think that the rain amounts will be a lot lighter than what we've been seeing. We'll probably see a net drying environment in many areas, but I think for the most part, this is going to be a beneficial change for a lot of the crop areas across the region. Now, there are a few pockets out there that really don't want a lot of drier weather, and so they may start to firm up a little bit more notable. We may end up with a slightly short topsoil moisture profile by the time we get to this time next week in a few areas, but it is not the beginning of a drought by any means. But we are going to see a little more of this as we move deeper into August. That's pretty normal for this time of the year. And our temperatures overall for the next week or so are going to run mostly in the 80s and lower 90s, with the exception of the Great Lakes region, where I think we will see some 70-degree readings occur a couple of different times over the coming week. The first round will probably occur as we move tomorrow into Friday, and then we'll see the same thing happen again about midweek next week.
A statistician from Indiana this week made note that there were some awful dry pockets in his state. Can you talk a bit about that, if there really are there, and what might be notable and how that might change in the coming week if it does?
There are definitely dry pockets in the eastern part of Indiana, also a few in some central locations, but mostly it seems to be in eastern sections of the state, also in western sections of Ohio. There's also some drier pockets out there in the far southern tip of Illinois and also westernmost sections of Kentucky, and there's a couple of other spots scattered randomly across some of the western parts of the Corn Belt in a few locations. The bottom line here is that these areas are running quite a bit lower on rainfall for the month to date. It's not critically dry by any means, but some of the rainfall as a percentage of normal has been in the range of maybe 30 to 65% of normal in some of these locations, which suggests that as we go into this drier period coming up here over the next week to 10 days, these will be the first areas to start showing a short topsoil moisture profile and be the first areas that might encounter a little moisture stress if we don't get well-timed precipitation. So we are going to watch this whole scenario a little bit more closely, because we are expecting the latter part of summer to have a little bit of a drier bias to it, and some of these pockets will eventually become of greater interest to the marketplace.
Let's move around the globe just a bit, maybe take up the Ukrainian wheat harvest. It should begin in earnest within the next 10 or 15 days. How are they set?
Well, some of the easternmost parts of the Ukraine are kind of involved with some of this drought that's been impacting Russia here recently. So some of that crop will be able to be harvested quickly because it is already dry, but they've lost some yield potential there. In the western two-thirds of Ukraine, I think the situation there is just fine. They've had a lot of moisture in recent weeks, but they are going to see that trend downward a little bit for a while. It should be a pretty good environment for them overall.
20 seconds on China.
China is going to have a little high-pressure ridge for the next 5 to 6 days. It's going to bake them dry across some of the northern portions of the country, but not in the key northeast provinces. Those three provinces, Heilongjiang, Liaoning, and Jilin, will likely see timely rainfall and also continue to see temperatures that are far less hot relative to the areas in the Yellow River Basin. So China in general will be okay, but there's going to be some stress in some of those north central areas.
Thanks much, Drew. Drew Lerner is with World Weather Incorporated out of Kansas City. Joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Wednesday afternoon.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today, we're going to talk about a Human Rights Watch article, paper, called Fields of Peril. It was authored by Zanna Corson Neff. She's the Deputy Director for Human Rights Watch Children's Rights Division and joins us from New York by phone today. Thank you, Zanna, for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Fields of Peril. What was Human Rights Watch wanting to look at? And it's kind of unique because this one's on agriculture in the United States.
It is. It is. Human Rights Watch works on human rights issues around the world and about 80 countries around the world. But we also work on human rights problems in the United States. And our concern is that children working in agriculture are granted fewer protections than all other working children, and that they're working in conditions that are often far more hazardous and at far younger ages than all other working children in the United States.
Tell me about the laws in the United States that govern adolescents in the workforce and how agricultural laws are exempted or differ slightly.
Well, the U.S. child labor law is basically pretty good, except when it comes to agriculture. And then there's a huge gaping hole. Now, to be clear, I'm only talking about kids who are working for hire. I'm not talking about kids who are working for their own parents' farms. But when it comes to kids who are working for hire, in agriculture, there is no minimum age at which a child can work on a small farm with their parents' permission. They can work on any size farm at age 12 with their parents' permission, and at age 14 on any farm even without their parents' permission. By comparison, in all other work, kids can't work at least until age 14. At age 14 and 15, they can do certain jobs that aren't considered too dangerous for kids, but the hours of work are limited so that it doesn't interfere with their going to school. So you can't work more than 3 hours a day bagging groceries on a school day, for example, and on a non-school day, more than 8 hours a week being a cashier at McDonald's. But on a farm, a child can work unlimited hours outside of school with no restrictions. The other big difference is the age at which kids can do work that's considered particularly hazardous for children. And in agriculture, kids can do any job, including hazardous work, at age 16. In all other industries, kids can't do that work until they're 18 years old. So it's totally illegal for example, a 16-year-old to use a chainsaw in a lumber yard or to drive a forklift in a warehouse. But that's totally legal on a farm.
This is both the beautiful and the ugly side of being a child on the farm, and then being a child for hire for labor is maybe more the ugly side. The beautiful side is that, and I grew up in this system, is that you've got to go work on the farm if your parents so desired, and I suppose depending on whether you so desired sometimes too, it's not fun to get up early in the morning and go to the bean field and walk or to work on the farm and with the livestock that early in the morning, especially as a child. But you learn a great number of things along the way, and there are reasons that there were exemptions, at least initially, so that children could work on the farm with their parents. But you're particularly worried, I think, in this study, Fields of Peril, about the children of migrant workers. Tell me the types of work that children are doing, and if I'm wrong about the target of the study too.
Well, we've looked at all kids who are working for hire, but migrant kids have an especially tough time. About 40% of all hired farm workers are migrant workers. And for migrant kids, you have the extra burden of migrating. And that means that migrant kids are often leaving school before school is actually finished, and sometimes going back to school weeks or months after school has already started. So I talked to migrant kids who said that they didn't remember a single year when they had enrolled in school on time, and kids who every year miss their final exams because they've already left to go work. And so you can imagine this has a horrific toll on their graduation rates from high school. Farm worker kids in general drop out at 3 times the national average. Most of the kids that I talked to who are migrants had been held back 1 or more times, and some said they didn't know anyone who had ever graduated from high school. So all farm worker kids are subjected or have experienced risks working on farms, but migrant kids have it especially tough. There's often serious problems with migrant housing, and so kids are not just experiencing problems in their work environment, but they may be experiencing problems in their home environment.
Yeah, to be clear, the law in the United States, as it refers to labor, differs for adults on agricultural labor as well. For instance, during the harvest and the planting season, truckers are allowed to be on the road more often than they might be because of the need to put that crop either in the bin or to get it into the ground, one of the two. So these laws are different from across the board in that scope.
Well, there are differences for all farm workers. Farm workers aren't entitled to overtime. They're exempt from some minimum wage provisions. In many states, they don't have the right to organize. And some of those gaps actually reduce family income and put more pressure on parents to send their kids to work. But when it comes to things like, you know, having no restrictions on working kids' hours in agriculture, you can have – I talked to 11-year-old kids who worked 10 or more hours a day, 12, 14 hours a day. Day at the peak of the harvest. Now, you know, that's how crops are harvested, but it doesn't mean we should have such young children working for such long hours, particularly when it takes such a toll on their health and their access to education.
You penned this article, and you have some key recommendations that you suggest for Congress. What are those?
The most important thing that can be done is to just apply the same standards that already apply to all other working kids to kids in agriculture. And that means that kids would have to be 14 years old to work for hire in agriculture. And when they're 14 and 15, have caps on the number of hours that they can work so that if they're trying to work and go to school, their schooling doesn't suffer. We should also change the law to make sure that kids aren't doing hazardous work until they're 18, because if it's too hazardous to do in any other job, it's too hazardous to do on the farm. And, you know, it's not surprising that fatality rates in agriculture are so much higher for working youth on farms than for all other sectors. They're more than 4 times higher. Now, there's a bill pending in Congress right now called the CARE Act, the Children's Act for Responsible Employment, and it has more than 92 co-sponsors in the House of Representatives, and listeners can actually call and ask their congresspeople to support this law that would provide the same protections for kids in agriculture as all other working kids already enjoy. It wouldn't keep kids from working on the farm. It would just say that the really young kids can't work, and you can't work so many hours that you put your health and education at risk.
How does the United States and laws in the United States compare to other nations around the world?
Well, like I said, I mean, a lot of our child labor laws are pretty good. The problem is this big exception for agriculture. Now, the United States is actually a leader in combating child labor around the world. The United States gives more money to combat child labor internationally than all other countries combined. It's really something outstanding about the United States. So it's a national embarrassment that we tolerate this one form of child labor that is so dangerous to kids. And we've actually gotten a lot of international criticism from the International Labor Organization for that. But, you know, we know how to fix it. It's an antiquated loophole, and we can change the law to provide the same protections for kids on farms as all other working kids.
Now, because I'm a farm boy, I understand why kids go to work on the farm or what they're doing on their own farms, their parents' farms. Why is it that child labor is used for hire in the United States? And some of that, I can remember dad hiring, you know, bean walking crews, though I have 5 brothers, so we didn't really often hire other people outside to walk beans. But why is it that child labor is hired for the detasseling crews to pick produce crops? Why does that happen?
Well, one reason kids are working at such young ages for such long hours is because it's absolutely legal. I mean, we're not going to criticize a farmer for hiring a kid when it's totally legal under the law. And the farmers have said to me, you know, if it's legal, how can I turn a child away? Because U.S. law says it's perfectly okay to send your 12-year-old to work on any large commercial farm. Kids are also working such long hours to put food on their table. You know, migrant and farm worker families are on average very poor. They tend to earn on average less than $18,000 a year for the entire family. And these kids are often really contributing to their family's income. But one reason the families are so poor is because the parents are making so little money. And I talked to so many parents who talked about being cheated out of minimum wage themselves, about not having good daycare so that they felt obliged to take their kids in the field. And a lot of parents who just said, you know, this is something we've always done. It's perfectly legal. It seems like a legitimate choice. But the truth is, you know, we don't let poor parents take their kids to a mine or to a mill and put them at risk because their families are poor. And farm kids shouldn't be exposed to those same risks.
Yes, your report says the average income would be something between $15,000 and $18,000 a year, I think, for these workers. And that there are something along the lines of 2.6 million hired hands in the United States, that'd be migrant workers, and that there are about 2.3 million teens in the workforce. That would be all teens. Do you know how many teens or adolescents? Do you know how many child laborers there might be in agriculture?
We know that there are hundreds of thousands of children working for hire in the United States. The truth is the U.S. government doesn't count them all. But they have counted a smaller subset of all hired farm workers and come up with 211,000 kids. Now, those are just kids who are working as direct hires for farmers, not for labor contractors, and they're kids who are working on the books. And we know a lot of kids work off the books, in part because, you know, 12-year-olds don't always have checking accounts where they can cash their checks. So we know 211,000 is a low count, but you know, the government hasn't counted all these kids, and that's one of our recommendations, that we ought to know how many kids are working for hire in agriculture.
Yeah, you have some suggestions for U.S. EPA along the way too, I think, right?
Right. I mean, one of the dangers that kids face in the field is exposure to pesticides. Kids absorb pesticides more easily than adults, and they excrete them more slowly. Pesticide exposure in acute exposure can cause brain damage, coma, death. But the low-level exposure that kids are experiencing can often cause things like hormonal disruption. It's associated with cancer and other diseases. And you can imagine if a kid from a very young age is having this constant exposure in the field, they're very much at risk. And things like hormonal disruptions affect kids differently because their bodies are still developing. Now, unfortunately, the standards about farm worker exposure to pesticides set by the EPA right now are just based on an adult body. They're set on an 154-pound male as a model. They don't take into account children or pregnant women or people who are really out there in the fields. And that's really placing kids at risk. So even if farmers comply with the regulations, for example, about how long workers have to stay out of the fields after they're sprayed, there have been cases where kids have actually been acutely poisoned by pesticides because the regulations didn't take kids' bodies into account.
We're talking today with Zema Korsen-Knepp. She's the Deputy Director of Children's Rights Division at Human Rights Watch in New York, and she is the author of an article called Fields of Peril. More with her here in a moment on The Farming World.
Learnard Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learnard Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Learnard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
Hey, if you give it a chance, why don't you give us a call or an email and tell us what you think of the farming world or the rest of our agricultural programming here from Illinois Public Media. We would like to hear from you from time to time. You can do that in a couple of ways. Dave Dickey and I are available online. You can visit willag.org and find our email address, or just use this one. It goes to both of us. We'll both get the email when you send it to WILLAG. Staff@illinois.edu. That's willagstaff@illinois.edu. Send us a line there if you'd like to talk to us a little bit about the farming world, the closing market report, or other agricultural programming. Or you can always dial in to us at 217-333-1070 and ask for either Dave or myself. That number is 217-333-1070. Either way, we're interested in what you think about the agricultural programming from Illinois Public Media. And if you have comments or suggestions for guests for the farming world, it's all available, of course, anytime you'd like on our website at willag.org. And if you're a producer, an agriculturalist, don't forget to sign up there for our weekend newsletter. It's a good one. And you can do that over on the right-hand side of the page at willag.org. Just hit subscribe. You can manage that subscription, too. And if you'd like to get a text from us, just give us your cell phone number when you manage your subscription. It all happens at willag.org. Agricultural programming, of course, is a production of Illinois Public Media from the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. This is The Farming World. It's a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. We're talking today with Human Rights Watch, Zayma Corson-Niff, about Fields Apparel, an article on farm labor and, in particular, child labor in the United States. When we last spoke with you, we had just brought up pesticides and exposure to pesticides that children get on the farm, especially if they're working in the fields for a very long time. You had pointed out that the risk cup in the United States, that's the amount of exposure that is allowed, is based on a male body of 154 pounds, as we closed out the first segment. But that risk cup, I know, is while it's based on 154 pounds, is for the pesticide that's being applied, the total number of times that pesticide could be applied to that crop, plus all the other pesticides and all the other times that they might be applied to that single crop in a year. So it doesn't matter whether the crop is sprayed once with the pesticide. What matters in the case of US EPA and the risk cup and the exposure that we're talking about is how many times that pesticide and all the other pesticides that are labeled for that particular crop can be sprayed in a single year. Do you not think that's good enough to cover children and women as well?
We think that risk assessment for pesticides ought to look specifically at what the effects on kids actually are. Now, there's actually something really good happening in the EPA right now, and that is they are considering this exact thing. They put out a call for public comment, and they are considering whether they should change how they assess risk to take kids into account. But we think when you're looking at the dangers of contact with pesticides, you ought to look specifically at how it affects kids and how it affects adults, because kids are affected differently.
If the child labor laws were changed to make it a 14-year-old, would you be less watchful on this particular issue? This will be a very large issue for agriculture, I know.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, blueberry farmers, for example, who have gotten a lot of scrutiny in the last year, have come out publicly and said, we don't need children in order to harvest our crops. And the U.S. Department of Agriculture has even come out and said, you know, there are so many farmers and ranchers who want to do the right thing, and no one should be exploiting kids in order to raise our food. So I actually think that there's a lot of sympathy, even among farmers themselves, for providing basic protections for kids. Because remember, this isn't about keeping teenagers from working. They'll still be able to work on farms. It just means they'll be protected from the work that's most dangerous for kids, and that really young kids won't be able to work for hire.
So what would you consider the most dangerous work for children?
Well, kids are dying from a number of things in agriculture. And remember that kids working in agriculture have a fatality rate for work that is more than four times higher than all other working kids. They're working with heavy equipment. They're working with sharp tools and machinery. They're often working in very hot temperatures. There was a teenage girl who died in 2008 from heat stroke in California after she'd been pruning grapevines for 9 hours. Agriculture can be a very dangerous place for kids. And what Human Rights Watch has said is that if a job is too dangerous outside the farm for kids, it should be too dangerous on the farm for kids. We ought to keep kids from dying at work on farms. And I think that's really something that everyone can support.
What kind of support and reaction have you had from your Fields of Peril?
Well, I think we've had, for the most part, very good support. I think Americans are shocked to realize that there is this big loophole in the law. I think a lot of people don't realize that you can legally have a 6 or 7 year old working for hire on a farm and exposed to pesticides and all the other risks. The EPA has come out and said many of our findings are sound. The Secretary of Labor has actually written to Congress and supported changing the policy that provides less protection for working kids. So I think we've had some really good support. But the thing that we really need now is for people to reach out to their congresspeople and say that they want to support the CARE bill, the Children's Act for Responsible Employment, and that they want Congress to provide the same protections for kids on farms as all other working kids.
Who are the sponsors of that bill?
It was introduced by Representative Roybal Allard, a representative in California, but it's now been sponsored by more than, I think the number now is 92 members of Congress, and there are more than 90 organizations around the United States that have gotten behind the bill and expressed their support. And that ranges from a variety of labor unions to groups like the National PTA Association, who all think this is a really important bill and time to just update our laws.
Are there any members of Congress in the Midwest or that sit on the Agriculture Committee that are sponsors of this bill?
There are, but we need more support. So if everyone can reach out to their congressperson, this is a really important time to do that. And if people want more information both about the problem for children working in the fields and what they can do to support their bill, including how to write their congressperson, they can log on to Human Rights Watch's website, which is www.hrw.org. Go to our children's rights page, and you can read the whole report. We have video information, and we have a quick and easy way you can write your congressperson.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Zayma Corson Neff. She's the Deputy Director of the Children's Rights Division for Human Rights Watch and authored the Fields of Peril article that you can find on their website at www.hrw.org. You've been listening to The Farming World. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.